It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Every week at this time, Lucky Strike throws a conversational party with questions and answers as the main entertainment. Here's how it goes. You furnish the questions, and our experts try to answer them. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more, plus a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid. And all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a Lucky Strike as I present our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please has no special rules, as you know. It's a completely unpremeditated and unrehearsed program. Tonight, our board of experts consists first of two of our regulars, the versifier and conning tower man, Franklin P. Adams, and the sports expert and author of The American Sporting Scene, John Curran. One of our guests is an old friend of Information Please, the author and lecturer, Miss Jan Struther. And our other guest is Joseph E. Davies, formerly ambassador to Russia, and now chairman of the President's Committee on War Relief Agencies, which gives aid to Russia, England, China, and our other allies. Mr. Davies' book, Mission to Moscow, will be published shortly. And ladies and gentlemen, before we begin our questions tonight, we have an announcement to make that's important to all Americans. The Red Cross needs a $50 million war relief fund and needs it now. Give to the Red Cross War Relief Fund through your local chapter, and may we urge that you give at once. Now, we'll start tonight's proceedings with a question from Miss Loretta K. Weiler of Philadelphia. Get 2 out of 3 on this 3-part question. It's about literary chaps all named Tom. Now, what Tom was mortally punished by the villain for not talking? These are all the people in fiction. He was mortally punished by the villain of the story because he didn't talk, wouldn't talk. Miss Struther.
Wasn't it Tom Tit, his tongue for the slip? Little Tom Tit, his tongue for the slip.
I don't know it. Is it a nursery rhyme? And yes. Why was the tongue slip? Sounds as if we're talking too much.
Well, it does, doesn't it?
I'm afraid
maybe
so.
We're wrong.
Now, this is an even better known Tom. It's Uncle Tom in the well-known cabin by the same name. Simon Legree, you remember, whipped him to death because Uncle Tom refused to give away the whereabouts of 2 female slaves, I think, that escaped. Does that come back to you now, Mr. Adams?
Yes, sir.
Got it?
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
We'll mark that one wrong, then. Now, what hero named Tom committed a larceny? Committed a larceny, Mr. Curran.
The Piper's son.
Yes.
Stole a pig and away he runs.
That's right. He's a pig stealer. And what one was chased out of a tavern? Chased out of a tavern. This is a Tom in a famous poem. Oh, I think we should get this. Doesn't come to any of you? I went into a public house to get a pint of beer.
Tommy Atkins,
yes. He goes into a public house, and the publican ups and says, "We serve no red coats here." I'm sorry that we'll have to get 2 out of 3 wrong on that. That sends $25 to Miss Weiler, plus a set of the encyclopedia. Now, how about this one? This comes from D.P. Liebich of Montgomery, Alabama. You're going to hear 3 scenes in a courtroom rehearsed here for you. What is wrong with each of them? Now, the first scene is a state court in Massachusetts.
The next case is the people of the state of Massachusetts versus John Doe.
John Doe, you are charged with high treason to the people of the United States. How do you plead?
Anything wrong with that? Mr. Davies.
Can't try a federal crime in a state court.
That's quite right. A federal crime in this case is treason. It could not be tried in a state court. Very good. Now, the next scene is the United States District Court of the District of Columbia.
Case of John Doe versus United States of America.
Your Honor, my client sustained serious injuries when hit by a United States mail truck and asks for $50,000 damages.
Mr. Davies again.
All suits against the United States have to be brought in a court of claims.
You can't sue the United States at all, then. That is in the ordinary...
You can on contract, but not under tort.
I beg pardon?
You can for contract, but not for wrongs called tort.
I see. I wouldn't ask you to explain that, Mr. Davis.
You didn't like my sentences.
Quite wrong.
No, Pollock on torts.
Our eminent legal student, Mr. Adams, helping you out. Yes, an action of this sort must be filed, as Mr. Davies reminds us, with a court of claims.
I'm still right, despite Mr. Adams.
Good enough. Now, the next scene is the lower criminal court of the state of Maryland.
George Punivich, step to the bar. You are charged by the town of Bethesda, free state of Maryland, with exceeding the legal and maximum speed limit of 30 miles an hour. How do you plead?
I claim diplomatic immunity because of my attachment to the Bulgarian consulate in the city of Annapolis.
I fine you $10.
How about that? Mr. Davies.
What is wrong about that?
Well, or what is right with it? Is the fine correct? Is the judge within his rights in overriding Mr. Punovich's claim for diplomatic immunity?
The court is wrong.
Why is the court wrong?
Because as a matter of international comity, a diplomat cannot be convicted of a crime in a state court.
Diplomatic has... what rank?
Oh, I guess I'm wrong.
Ah, it might be so. That's happened even to diplomats before.
I know. I've been there.
Now, in this case, Mr. Davies, the diplomat is a consul. He's a diplomatic consul in the city of Annapolis. Is he immune from prosecution?
No, he's subject to the laws of the state. It's only the personal representative of the government who is the head of the mission that is entitled to diplomatic immunity.
That is exactly right. In other words, the ambassador or the public minister, and I understand his domestic or domestic servants are also
anyone
immune.
In his habitat, and, in home.
I see.
Right.
Was that true for you when you were in Russia, Mr. Davis?
Oh, definitely. So
they have the same system over there.
Oh, it's about an international comedy, Russia is very decent about that.
Very good. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3 at least, or 2.5 out of 3 if we accept Mr. Davies' emendation. And how about this from R.T. Lang of Kittening, Pennsylvania? Get 2 out of 3. What did each of these carry? William Dawes, D-A-W-E-S. Mr. Adams.
William Dawes was the Paul Revere pal.
That's right.
And,
what did he carry?
He carried a lantern.
Well, I don't think he carried a lantern. He might have.
Or two, if I see.
Well, wasn't that... Well, Mr. Sheehan, wasn't that the signal? Well, he carried a message, Mr. Adams. That's what you really mean. He carried the same message that Paul Revere did, that the English were coming.
And a lantern.
And did he carry a lantern to him, Mr.
Yes,
Davis?
Paul Revere did, didn't he? And so did that other guy in Greece.
Who carried it on? Diogenes?
Yeah, didn't he?
Right, he did. That's quite true. It's a little remote.
Didn't Paul Revere have a lantern, too?
I believe Paul Revere had a lantern. And what other, beside Dawes and Revere, carried the same message to every Middlesex village and farm? There were 3 messengers. The other was Prescott. And the only one of these 3 that we remember is Paul Revere because of Mr. Longfellow's poem. Now, what
4 of them?
Were there 4? You know, things are getting kind of
Paul Revere's horse.
Mr. Adams is always very kind to dumb animals on this show.
He has a horse on Paul.
What did each, what did Aeneas carry? Aeneas, Mr. Curran.
Carried his father, Anchises,
yes,
on his back.
On his back, out of...
Being a pious man.
Burning short. And Rosinante carried... Miss Strother?
Don Quixote, or Quixote, or however you like to pronounce it.
How do you like to pronounce it?
I like Don Quixote, myself.
Okay, we'll make it Don Quixote. Rosinante, of course, was...
What?
Mr. Adams' favorite animal. It was the horse of Don
Quixote. Oh, yes, Quixote. Yes, I thought that was...
That gives us 3 out of 3.
Good.
Dorothy Kickhafer of Kew Gardens sends this one in. Identify these contemporaries. The first is a Russian with an English wife. A Russian with an English wife. Mr. Davies.
Mr. Litvinov.
Yes, Mr. Litvinov, here on a mission from Russia. Identify a Japanese with a German wife, which seems like a very well-suited couple. A Japanese with a German wife. Famous contemporary. for not too long a time, we'll hope. That would be Foreign Minister Shigenori Togo of the land of the so-called Rising Sun. What contemporary is a Chinese married to a Wellesley graduate? Mr. Kieran.
General Kai Shek.
Yes.
Whatever his name is.
Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek married one of the famous Song sisters. Now, that gives us 2 out of 3. How about this one from Barbara Easley of New York? Again, get 2 out of 3 if you can. This is a poetry question. I'm going to ask you to recite a line or lines of poetry about first a gate, then a door, and finally an exit or exits. Let's have a line of poetry about a gate.
It matters not how stated the gate, how charged with circumstance the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of myself.
That's peachy. That's very good, Mr. Bailey. Very good. One word wrong in that.
How punishment.
Punishments, as Mr. Adams reminds us. Mr.
You want a door?
I'd love a door.
There was a door to which I found no key. There was a veil through which I could not see, and so forth, from the group I had.
Oh, that's a very unfamiliar one, Miss Kira. Very good. When you say and so forth, of course, you assume that I know how it goes on. You're wrong. Now, finally, a line of poetry about exit or exits. Miss Strother.
They have their exits and their entrances.
Yes, a very good line. From what play of Shakespeare's is that?
Hamlet, All the World's a Stage.
It's not, Miss Kira?
As You Like It.
It's from As You Like It, yes. Sounds sort of Hamlet-ish, but it's from As You Like It. Does that surprise you, Miss Strother?
It surprises me a great deal.
Well, Mr. Kieran's right. That gives us 3 out of 3. Now, how about this one? This is from Ernest Butt of Flushing, New York. Again, get 2 out of 3. It's a sports question. What sports event takes place annually between the following locations on the map? From Hopkinson to Boston. A sports event taking place between Hopkinson and Boston, Mr. Kieran.
Well, I don't know what Hopkinson is, but I suppose that's the Boston Marathon, isn't it?
That's right. I suppose Hopkinson is a town sufficiently far from Boston to make the Boston Marathon possible. You'll probably hear from Hopkinson in the morning, Mr. Kieran. How about Putney to Mortlake? Putney to Mortlake, Miss Strother.
The Oxford and Cambridge boat race.
Yes, the famous Oxford
the
Cambridge
boat race.
I
mean,
I beg your pardon. As an Englishwoman, I'm entitled to be specific if I want to.
From New York to Bermuda. New York to Bermuda, Mr. Kieran.
I think it's off this year. There's a yacht race from... from London to Bermuda.
No, there is
an
yacht race.
They have a... Yacht races from both places, I think.
Sure, they do have it, however, from New York to Bermuda also.
They bet nothing else could be but a yacht race from New York to Bermuda.
Yeah, you couldn't very well have a marathon. True enough. Do you say that off this year, Mr. Kieran?
I think most ocean yachting is off.
I imagine it's imagine so, yes. Well, so far, Lucky Strike has paid out $25 in one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and now Mr. Cross points out that when it comes to Gilbert and Sullivan, nearly anyone can quote a few lines, but it takes an expert like Mr. Adams to repeat whole stanzas.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, expert knowledge makes a big difference when it comes to cigarettes, too. For in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. And when a man knows tobacco, he knows cigarettes. Now, the South's independent tobacco experts spend their lives buying, selling, and handling the leaf. So their overwhelming preference for one cigarette, Lucky's, means a lot. Let me just give you an example of what they see at auction after auction. In Goldsboro, North Carolina this season, the American Tobacco Company paid 29% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 29% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And the best tobacco we buy goes into Lucky's. The result is Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. And that's why, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-1. Mr. Fadiman, isn't that a good reason for trying the tobacco expert cigarette?
Yes, Mr. Cross, you've shown us both the reason and the advantages, and in just 59 seconds. Now, how about this one from Verda Zimmerman?
Thank God for the profit motive in advertising.
This one's from Verda Zimmerman of Omaha, Nebraska. I'm going to ask you to supply the missing characters in these scenes. I'll describe each one. The first scene is a tea party. We have the Mad Hatter, the March Hare, and Alice, who's missing from the tea party. Mr. Kieran.
Dormouse.
Yes, the Dormouse. So the Dormouse doesn't do very much to help things along. He sleeps.
he's what we might call a frank guest, instead of the ones who are less frank at tea parties and keep awake when they need him. How about this one? There's a commission meeting in Washington, and you see, at the commission meeting, Mr. Ed Hurley, Mr. William I. Harris, Mr. Joseph E. Davies. One missing, Mr. Davies.
Guilty.
A big
Federal Trade Commission.
Who was that?
The Federal Trade Commission.
That was the Federal Trade Commission. Who's the guest that's missing from the quartet?
George Roublie.
Well, now, my information may be wrong. This is 1914.
1914.
You're right. You remember at that time. William H. Perry, was that
Perry? Perry of Seattle.
Yes, that would be quite right. Well, your memory does go back quite a long way, Mr. Davis.
Unfortunately.
How about this? Now, there's a banquet set for three. It's prepared by Esther. Esther, for King Ahasuerus and what other guest? Now, we are here in the Old Testament, of course. Banquet is set, Mr. Adams?
Haman.
Haman is right. Haman, yes, to hang as high as Haman. Very good. Thank you. Now, how about this? Mrs. Lillian F. Owen of Portland, Oregon, sends this one in. What was the occupation of the person referred to in each of these quotations? Get two out of three. Here's the first quotation. A man he was to all the country dear and passing rich with 40 pounds a year. What's his occupation? Miss Strada, was that your hand, Mr. Kieran?
No, no.
That's more of a goldsmith's deserted village. And I think he was the schoolmaster.
No.
Well, he's a preacher.
That's quite right. He was the parson. I wish I hadn't heard you say the schoolmaster, Mr. Kieran.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't remember.
You meant the parson. How about this one? The emptiness of ages in his face and on his back the burden of the world. Mr. Kieran.
He was an agricultural worker.
He wouldn't have
the
known
man with the hoe.
Yes, the man with the hoe.
Edwin Markham.
Quite right. Edwin Markham's famous poem. Now, how about this occupation? Peeping through keyholes, running after fire engines like a lot of coach dogs, waking people up in the middle of the night to ask them what they think of Mussolini, a lot of Daffy Budinski swelling around with holes in their pants, borrowing nickels from office boys. What are these people? Any idea? The quotation rings no bell, Mr. Adams?
No bell, whatever. It's science.
No, heavens no. Goodness gracious. In that case, Miss...
They wouldn't be field workers for the Gallup poll, would they?
It sounds as if they would, no. Mr. Davies, I wish you hadn't said to columnists, because there are... Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran are both journalists, and the reference in the quotation is to journalists. And I can assure you...
In what work?
In the front page by Heston MacArthur. Well, still in all, you didn't get it. Shall we call that wrong, Mr. Kieran? Shall we accept
it? I'd call it wrong, and
send $25. Send $25 to Mrs. Lillian Owen and a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. How about this one from Mrs. Hilda R. Stice of Urbana, Illinois? Get two out of three. What men currently hold the offices that were previously held by the following? Held at one time by William Phillips. What office is now held by, rather, what person now holds that office? Yes?
Sumner Wells.
Sumner Wells. And what office is it?
Under Secretary of State.
Under Secretary of State. Walter F. George. Well, who holds his job now? Mr. Davies.
Tom Connolly.
Tom Connolly. And what is the office?
Chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate.
Yes, and very important job. And Sam D. McReynolds. Sam D. McReynolds.
Sam...
Mr. Brother and gentlemen, you're letting Mr. Davies do all the work.
Well, you're having a lovely time.
Sam D. McReynolds?
Sam D. McReynolds.
Well, you did very well. We have two out of three. We're safe. That's the job now held by Mr. Saul Bloom, Chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. Mr. Saul Bloom. All right, how about this? From Edmund Hutchinson of Washington, D.C. Name three instances in which a lamp or a lantern figured prominently, neither fact or fiction. Mr. Curran.
Aladdin had a very good lamp.
Yes, a very good lamp. Miss Strother.
Florence Nightingale had a ditto.
Had a equally good lamp, perhaps even more useful. And Mr. Adams, you had your hand up?
Well, it isn't fiction exactly, but
no, it can be.
There's Paul Revere.
Oh! I see you and Mr. Davies are cooperating on Paul Revere. Mr. Curran?
I have another one that isn't fiction, the Statue of Liberty.
It's a torch. Perhaps, rather than, well, I guess that would be considered a lamp or lantern.
Lamp unto my feet.
Yes, true.
What about Wee Willie Winkie? Did he have run through the town, you know?
Yes, and what did
he lit the lanterns. Maybe he just had a taper. That
he had a lamp lighter, but didn't have a lamp. There was the lantern that was kicked over by Mrs. O'Leary's cow, this very famous lantern. Mr. Davis, were you going to say, give us that one?
Well, it came back to me.
Well, that gives us three or four famous lamps or lanterns. Now, how about this from Marion Fisher of San Diego, California? Get two out of three. From these descriptions, can you name these prominent men? Now, the first one was born in Germany, became a senator from Missouri, and helped elect Lincoln. Who was that, Mr. Adams?
Carl Schurz.
No question. Carl Schurz. Very good. Now, this one was born in England, settled in New York, and became a trade union leader. Who was that? Mr. Kieran.
John L. Lewis.
I think not.
Green.
I beg pardon?
Green.
Green. Did he settle in New York?
AF&L.
I'm not sure. My answer is Samuel Gompers.
I think Green's right. Englishman also.
Yes, I do think so. Mr. Lewis is a Welshman.
Mr. Lewis is a Welshman.
Green is a Welshman, too, in part.
Is he? Is he so? Or were they both born in Wales, or were they born here? Do you remember?
I'm not sure.
Mr. Lewis was born in Wales.
He was born in Wales. I don't know whether he settled in New York. He now seems to be settled in Washington. can you name one who was born in New York and became premier of a foreign republic? That's a tough one.
No, that's very easy.
For you?
De Valera.
De Valera, yes. Very good. Well, I don't think most of us would have remembered that, Mr. Kieran, that Premier De Valera was born right here in New York. That gives us two out of three. Now, how about this from Gene Lyman of San Diego, California, also? Name a book written for children by each of these authors. Now, the first is Charles Dickens. Now, be careful. A book written for children by Charles Dickens. This is a tricky one, Mr. Adams.
A Child's History of England.
That's very good. Most of the books that we think of as being written for children, such as A Christmas Carol, were, of course, written for everyone. Child's History of England. Not a very good book. I think it was Chesterton who said that it was not so much written for children as written by a child. Charles Kingsley wrote a book for children. Mr. Kieran.
Water Babies.
The Water Babies. John Ruskin wrote a book for children. Mr. again.
Tales of the Golden River.
I hear
wonderful story.
A plug, eh?
Yep.
John Ruskin, The King of the Golden River. That's quite right. A very good story. And Nathaniel Hawthorne, On Our Side of the Water. Miss Struther.
Tanglewood Tales.
Tanglewood Tales. Have you read them?
Oh, yes. I was brought up on them.
Tanglewood Tales and The Wonder Book.
And yes, both adapted from Greek mythology, I believe. That gives us four out of four. Here's one from Betty Edward of Milton, Massachusetts. I like this one. Get two out of three. What's the difference between, or shall we say among, biscuit, muffin, and bun? Biscuit, muffin, and bun. I want precise answers. Miss Struther.
No, I was just scratching my right ear because all those words mean something different here from what they do in England, so I better
not. A biscuit would be your cracker.
That's right, and your cracker would, I mean, what we call a cracker would be what you call a snapping motto.
Oh, so we would.
Yes.
I have never been more confused in my life.
Cracker the next morning.
Now, if you are through with your snapping mottos, we will endeavor to find out what, in this country, a biscuit, a muffin, and a bun mean. Now, come, gentlemen, what is a biscuit? Mr. Adams.
A biscuit is something that you put in the oven.
Not permanent.
Made out of dough.
Yes, yes. That's safe enough.
That's all I know. Very good with butter.
Miss Struther?
It rises to about 8 times its normal size under the influence of heat in the oven.
Not only under the influence of heat, but what else is put into it?
Baking powder.
There we are, Mr. Davies. Now you have it. Baking powder. That's quite right. That's what gives a biscuit its peculiar property. It's a small loaf or cake of bread raised or shortened or made light with baking powder. Now, how about a muffin? A muffin differs from a biscuit, sometimes violently. What is a muffin? Any idea?
I don't know. I had one for breakfast.
I think it's the same thing without the baking powder. It's much heavier and it sometimes has blueberries in it.
It's generally toasted.
Often toasted, as Mr. Davis reminded.
That's an English muffin.
But it's made with some particular, just as we put soda or baking powder into a biscuit, we put what into a muffin, always?
Yeast.
No, no. Be quiet, Mr. Adams.
It has to have dough.
Yes, of course.
We all have.
It's made with eggs. made with eggs. At least that's what it says here. Miss Strother, isn't that true? Do you make muffins with
maybe,
eggs?
Maybe. I always just buy them at a drugstore.
Even so, they're made with eggs originally. Now, Mr. Adams, that muffin you made, you ate this morning, is made with
eggs. Muffin you speak of.
Coffee and toasted English, that's what I asked for.
I'll call the muffin wrong, and tell me now what a bun is, a bun.
No quotes.
I beg pardon?
Bun, no quotes.
Bun, no quotes.
You don't mean a twist of hair at the nape of the neck or anything?
No, like no, not that sort of bun.
No, hot cross.
Oh, hot cross.
Not the kind of bun that Mr. Adams is more familiar with. No idea, John.
Well, it's made out of something like the same material that goes into bread.
Yes.
Soft stuff.
But what's its main character?
It's a small loaf of bread.
Well, not a loaf, Mr.
Well, no, but you put yeast in it.
You do what?
Put yeast in it.
You might do that.
It's a miniature loaf.
Oh, but the important thing about a bun is that it's what?
Sugar. Oh,
of course.
Oh.
Well, there you see.
Now, you knew that all along, Mr. Kieran.
And slightly inedible.
Oh, no.
Now, perfectly edible, but not digestible.
Parts of it are very good sometimes. It has a glazing of sugar, milk, and spice on the top crust generally. It's a kind of cake or bread. I don't think I should give you full credit on that. Would you say so, Mr. Davies?
I'd say we lost on that.
I think you all did very badly. Miss Strother, if I should now ask you what the difference is in English, in England, would you be able to...
It would take too long, I think.
Take too long? All right. Suppose I send $25 instead of the Britannica, then, to Miss Betty Edward of Milton, Massachusetts. Biscuit, muffin, and bun. Now, by this time, I'm quite confused myself and couldn't tell you the difference in any circumstances. Well, let's see. We seem to have finished all the questions at my disposal, and now Mr. Cross tells us of an encounter he had recently with a young gentleman just out of college.
Well, Mr. Fadiman, he had majored in economics at college, so he was very interested in our comments about advertising on this program, particularly the fact that if we did no advertising at all, the price you pay for a package of Luckies would not be reduced one iota. Mr. Cross, he said earnestly, I learned something from your program I didn't learn in college. Well, ladies and gentlemen, surprising as it may seem, the total cost of all our advertising activities is such a small fraction of a cent per package that if it were entirely eliminated, the saving per package could not be passed on to you. The makers of Luckies have always believed that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. The tobacco, not the advertising. And we consistently pay what it costs to get the milder, better tasting tobacco for Luckies. For instance, this season at Oxford, North Carolina, we paid 25% more than the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture, 36% more at Dillon, South Carolina, and so on, all over the South. Yes, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Why not make your next package, Luckies, and prove to yourself that it's the tobacco that counts?
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out $75.03 of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Miss Strella. Thank you, Mr. Davies, for coming to Lucky Strike's party tonight. Now, next week, that dependable trio will be back. Mr. Franklin P. Adams, Mr. Oscar Levant, and Mr. John Kieran. And our guest will be the world-famous journalist, John Gunther, presently returning from England. Now, remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. And if the question stumps our experts, you not only get $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Remember to send your letters with questions and the correct answers to us at Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now we'll listen to a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
When you hear that chant, ladies and gentlemen, remember that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts, and Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. By the way, have you seen the new Lucky Strike gift chest? 500 Luckies in flat 50s and 20s, packed in a handsome natural grain sycamore chest. It's an ideal Christmas present for anyone you specially want to please. Ask to see it tomorrow at your favorite cigarette counter.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
It's 8:30 New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Every week at this time, Lucky Strike throws a question and answer party. Here's how it goes. You furnish the questions, and our experts try to answer them. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more, plus a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid, and all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, Information Please is a completely unrehearsed and happy-go-lucky program. And tonight our board of experts consists of our three regulars, Franklin P. Adams, John Kieran, and Oscar Levant. And our guest is the world-famous journalist and author of Inside Latin America, John Gunther, who has arrived just this week from Europe. And now we're off with a question coming to us from Beth Walker of Newtown, Connecticut, and a very nice town it is, too. It's about bells. You're going to hear, played by our studio pianist, three different songs. Tell me what the bells are doing in each of these songs, and get two out of three if you can. Ready with the first one, Joe? I have two hands. I have three hands. Mr. Adams.
The temple bells.
Yes. What are they doing?
Probably ringing.
Yes, they're doing something specific in the poem, Mr. Kieran.
Calling, come you back to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play.
Yes, come you back, you
British
really
soldier.
Which is, a matter of fact, they're back there now, Mr. Gunther, aren't they? Somewhere
yes.
around Mandalay in full force. Yes.
We are.
Now the second one's a little harder. What are the bells doing in the next song?
Oh, yeah, that Spanish town, that girl. What's her name? She's an Indian, too. You know that picture they always
have. I know.
It starts with the Ra.
Ramona.
Ramona.
Right. And what are the bells doing in Ramona?
Probably telling her what time it is. I don't know.
Any ideas, gentlemen? Mr. Levant.
Well, no, Ramona. Da-da-da, bells.
That's right. You're okay, Mr.
Levant. Da-da-da, bells.
Hear the mission bells above. Ramona, they're ringing out our song of what? What rhymes with above, Mr.
Dove.
You're fooling. The bells are ringing out our song of love. Now the third and last. Mr. Kieran.
Bells are ringing for me and my gal.
Yes, that's quite right. Well, perhaps that question about bells is a little too easy for you, shrewd gentlemen. How about this one from Joe Connors of Minneapolis? This is about heroines of literature who are famous for, this is a specialty act, who are famous for leaning out of windows. I want you to name three heroines who are famous for leaning out of windows and for nothing else, practically. Mr. Adams, start us off.
The Blessed Damozel.
Yes, she leaned out of what, Mr. Adams? What sort of a window? Or from where did she lean? Mr. Kieran.
The Golden Bar of Heaven.
Yes, that's right. The Blessed Damozel in Rossetti's poem. Mr. Gunther.
Melisande.
Oh, that's right.
What did she lean out of, Mr. Gunther?
She leaned out of an opera by, somebody,
Debussy wrote the...
Yes.
She leaned out of a tower to comb her hair was so long and golden.
Was that Melisande?
I got some of the dandruff on the first go.
Mr. Kieran?
Rapunzel.
Rapunzel was the one who,
wove her hair into a ladder for a friend of hers to use for purposes of his own.
Yes. That's correct. Well, there we have Melisande, Rapunzel, and the Blessed Damozel, all famous for leaning out of windows. There are a number of other heroines. Mr. Adams, did you think of another?
No.
How about Barbara Frietchie? Remember Barbara Frietchie, who leaned out of the window, gray head and all?
From her attic window.
From her attic window. All right, Mr. Adams. How about Bess in The Highwayman's Daughter, Mr. Kieran? That right? And... Mr. Kieran, can you give me one word which means to throw out of a window? There's a word which means to throw out of a window. It's of more importance. Do you know it?
Defenestrate?
Defenestrate, to throw out of a window. It may come in handy to some of our listeners someday. The next one from Ruth H. Thurlow of West Newbury, Massachusetts. Get two out of three.
During the First World War, paralleled in his office the following. Byron Price. Who paralleled his job in the First World War? Mr. Gunther.
George Creel.
Yes, and the job is what?
Chief Censor.
Yes, Chief Censor, quite right.
Mr. Creel got in a lot of trouble, too.
We hope Mr. Byron Price will. How about George C. Marshall? Who held his job, Mr. Levant, during the First World War?
I'm sure it wasn't Pershing, which I was going to say.
Then don't say it.
I won't say it.
All right, fine. That's a perfect score so far. Mr. Kieran.
General Peyton C. March.
General Peyton C. March. What's his title? What was his title?
Chief of Staff of the United States Army.
That's quite right. Now, Peyton C. March took over in 1918. During 1917 and part of 1918... Mr. Gunther?
Well, I was thinking of the man who succeeded March, who was General Tasker H. Bliss.
No, he preceded him.
He preceded him. In other words, I got what you wanted by accident.
That's right. By accident. You just got the time wrong. Generals Bliss and March were both Chief of Staff during the First World War. Now, General Louis B. Hershey, who took charge of his job during the First World War? Mr. Levant.
It wasn't Joe Johnson, was it?
No, it was not.
He always says he...
That's one wrong. Mr. Gunther.
I believe it was a general named Crowder.
Yes.
That's right.
Enoch Crowder. Enoch Crowder, in charge of what? What was his job?
The draft.
Yes, a selective service, as it's more politely called. That gives us 2 out of 3. How about Catherine Packard's question? This comes from Miss Packard of West Orange, New Jersey. Again, get 2 out of 3. It's about mistakes. A common occurrence on this program. Here's one about... famous mistakes in plays or stories or poems. In what play does a man commit suicide because of a mistake? A man commits suicide because of a mistake. As a result of a mistake, let's say. Mr. Adams.
Othello.
Commit suicide as a result of a mistake? I don't think that's
true.
He
called it about the handkerchief.
I know one.
Don't remember. Mr. Levant?
Romeo.
Yes. Romeo commits suicide. What mistake does he make?
Well, it's wonderful I said Romeo, don't you say?
You think that's enough for you, Mr. Kieran?
I thought Juliet was dead.
Yes. When actually she's what?
She was in a coma.
In a coma, yes, under the influence of the famous potion. And what story or poem does a deliberate mistake, result in a love affair? That's a tricky one, Mr. Levant.
In Junior Miss.
I don't know the story.
Well, if you get $3, go sometime. I'll tell you.
You must own a piece of it.
Well,
there's a more famous story.
Well, let's hold it in advance till you get there.
All right, Mr. Kieran.
Well, in Twelfth Night.
In Twelfth Night. What's the deliberate mistake there that results in a love affair?
Well, the Duke thought that the girl was Cesario was a man and hired her for his page.
But was it a deliberate mistake? I don't know what a deliberate mistake is.
I know it.
Do you know, Mr.
Tristar and Isolde?
Yes, that's the one I was asking. Will you explain that for us, Mr.
Well, the potion was to knock them off, and instead it became a love potion. The woman hanging around taking orders switched the potions, and they got hotter as the third act.
Yes, Brang Wayne substituted the love potion for what should have been a death potion, and as a result, you have Wagner's opera. In what story or play was a mistake hailed as a novel technique in motion pictures? A mistake hailed as a novel technique in motion pictures. That is a tough one.
You don't mean a mechanical mistake, like a photographic mistake?
Something of that sort. Any ideas, Mr. Levant?
Citizen Kane wasn't a mistake.
No. The one I was thinking of, Mr. Gunther?
Well, years ago, that business of having an actor play two roles on the screen...
That was economy, not a mistake.
That wasn't an error. That wasn't a mistake. Now, in Once in a Lifetime, well-known comedy a couple of years ago, there was a man who cracked Indian nuts by error. By error, this was the sound machine picked it up, and the motion picture that resulted was hailed as a great innovation. Remember that, Mr.
Yeah.
I guess we sent $25 to Miss Packard, plus a set of the Britannica on that. How about this one from Miriam Batista of The City? Now, this is a question whose answer I think we all of us should know or try to remember. Get 2 out of 3. Give within 100 miles the distance between these places. Vladivostok to Tokyo. Within 100 miles either way. Mr. Gunther, want to take that?
I'll take a chance on it. 750.
That would be just about right. 700 miles approximately is what the distance is. Short enough. San Francisco to Honolulu. That's not so easy. San Francisco to Honolulu. Mr. Levan had his hand up first.
Well, that doesn't say I'm a good choice. 2,900 and something.
To Honolulu?
No, no, I didn't have my hand up.
Well, what was that thing you had waving around? Mr. Curran?
Well, let's see. 3,324. It's around 5,000 miles.
San Francisco to Honolulu?
Oh, no.
San Francisco to Honolulu in the Philippines?
Yeah.
No, 1782.
1782, says Mr. Adams. Mr. Gunther?
No, oh, Hawaii. Yeah. Oh, I know what that is.
Mr. Gunther?
Well, I should say that is 2,400 miles.
Yes, that you've got it. Almost within.
Well, I was thinking I was going all the way to the Philippines.
You're in a hurry. 2,402 miles from San Francisco to Honolulu.
Was I 2 miles out?
You're 2 miles out, yeah. How about Manila to Singapore? Manila to Singapore. Mr. Gunther?
It's about 900, I should say.
No, you'd be out on that, considerably out. The distance from Manila to Singapore is 1,576 miles. Exactly. It's a long way. Well, I really
it took me 3 days in a boat. That's right. I remember now.
Well, that would be, you see,
a long time ago.
Yes, 1,576 miles. And that, I think, sends $25 to Miss Batista and a set of the encyclopedia. Just to repeat on that, a lot of us talk to Tokyo, 700 miles. San Francisco to Honolulu, 2,402 miles. Manila to Singapore, 1,576 miles. And how about this one from Charles B. Overman of Arlington, Virginia? Get 2 out of 3. Identify the lines of poetry and quote them if you can, which end with these rhyming words. I'll just give you the end rhymes. You give me the lines of poetry. Here's the first set. Me, your, sea, bore, shore. All you have to do is fill in the lines which end with those rhyming words. Shall I repeat them, Mr. Adams? Me, your, sea, bore, shore.
Bore spelled how?
B-O-R-E.
Sounds
like poem.
Mr. Curran.
That I think it is to his own native shore. Is that the?
That's the one. Yes.
All right. Then that is Helen to Helen,
yes,
by Edgar Allan Poe.
That's right. Can you give us the lines, Mr. Adams? Can you give us the lines?
It's just
Helen, my beauty is to me.
That's very good.
Like those Nicene barks of yore that softly wafted o'er a perfumed sea, the weary, wayworn traveler bore to his own native shore.
Yes, that's almost perfect. I suppose that's generally thought of as one of the most beautiful lyrics ever written in this country.
He's as good as Karen.
Poet, you mean?
No, John.
Now, here's another set of rhyme words. Plain, which is P-L-A-I-N. You, again, new. Plain, you, again, fill in the lines.
There's no spell G-N-U?
No, that's spelled N-E-W, just to make it hard.
Say those once again, please.
Yes, I shall, Mr. Karen. Plain, P-L-A-I-N. You, again, new.
And did you once see Shelley Plain?
That's right.
It's by Robert Browning.
Yes, that's very good, Mr. Curran. How does it go on?
Well, they don't stop and speak to you.
That's right. And how does it go on from there, Mr. Adams?
Did you speak to him again? How
strange.
How strange it is and new.
That's right. From Browning's memorabilia. That's very good going, Mr. Adams, Mr. Curran. Thank you both very much. Now, how about this one? I think this is even harder. Flight, night, strikes, light. Had Mr. Kieran's hand up at once on that.
Well, of course, there are variations on those quatrains.
You going to give them all to me?
I really don't know which one. That's the opening stanza of one of the versions of Fitzgerald's translations of Rubaiyat.
That's quite right, Mr.
And I need the first line because I know two or three.
Wake for the sun.
Wake for the... Oh, well, I have another one. Wake for the sun has shattered in... Driven into flight the stars before him from the field of light, and lo, the hunter of the east has caught the sultan's turret in a noose of light.
Yes, that's one of the variations. That's pretty good going, Mr. Curran. Any of you, by the way, who think this sort of thing is easy, can pick out the famous rhyme words of famous lines and try it on your next-door neighbor and see how well he makes out. Well, so far, Lucky Strike has paid out $50 and 2 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, Mr. Cross gives us a bit of modern Euclid, the easy-to-understand variety, let me add.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the geometry of common sense, good tobacco is the shortest distance to a good smoke. For you know, if you stop to think of it, that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. So the amount of enjoyment you get out of a cigarette depends upon the kind of tobacco that goes into it. That's why Lucky Strike consistently pays the price to get the milder, better-tasting tobacco for Luckies. This season, for example, at auctions in Smithfield, North Carolina, the American Tobacco Company paid 31% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 31% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And the best tobacco we buy goes into Lucky's. So it goes at market after market all over the South. Clearly, then, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Mr. Fadiman, have I demonstrated that Lucky's are worth trying?
In true Euclidean style, Mr. Cross, with the facts and the figures, and it took you only 57 seconds.
And now we'll go on with a question coming to us from Mrs. Clement A. Palazzolo of Massena, New York. Name four book titles in which any kind of foreign money is mentioned. Mr. Levant.
Kopeck by Durante.
You've got part of the title.
One cent, one kopeck.
By Walter Durante, the famous correspondent. Very good. Now, Mr. Gunther, help us out.
Barry's, the 10-pound loaf.
Yes.
12 pounds.
12. Be generous.
Yeah, of course.
Barry was Scotch, but you needn't be. The 12-pound loaf, yes. How about two more titles that use any kind of foreign currency?
Frank and somebody.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Who is the somebody?
Mr. Adams.
Frank in the Lower Mississippi.
Yes, Frank in the Lower Mississippi. By whom, Mr. Adams?
Harry Castleman.
Yes, I bet you could go on and tell us about Frank ad infinitum. Frank on the Upper Mississippi.
Moon and Sixpence.
The Moon and Sixpence by H. Thomas at Moore. Can you think of any with a Chinese coin? Mr. Gunther, you're an Asiatic expert. I mean, an expert on Asia.
Yeah, I have one.
Mr. Levant?
The bitter tea of General Yen.
That's a very good one. The bitter tea of General Yen. Yen is a Chinese coin. I don't know how much it's worth, Mr. Gunther.
What is it? You can buy tea, evidently.
Apparently. 100 million guinea pigs was a bestseller of some years ago. There are a
million pound note.
The million pound note. Very good. How about this one from Robert Hogg of Warm Springs, Georgia? Who are the men in command of the separate forces of the Allies in the Far East? Who's in command of the forces of China? Well, that is perhaps a fairly easy one, Mr. Gunther.
Well, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek.
Yes, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. Now, how about England? Who's in command of the Far East forces in England? Mr. Kieran.
General Wavell.
In the Far East.
What do you call the Far East? He's out in...
The Middle East.
He was conferring with Kai-shek and General Brett.
Yes, but he's not in command of the Allied forces.
Oh, sorry. I know.
Mr. Gunther?
It's an Air Chief Marshal commanding, Brooke Popham.
Yes.
And Wavell is Commander-in-Chief in India, and as Commander-in-Chief in India, has been traveling around and inspecting his adjoining areas.
But he wouldn't be considered in command of the entire
Brooke
army.
Brooke Popham is in charge.
Now, I understand that Sir Robert Brooke Popham has just been relieved of his post just as of this afternoon. And now Lieutenant General Pownall, P-O-W-M-A-L-L, is in command. Had you any of you heard that?
No, why did you ask the question?
Now, how about our own forces in the Far East? Who is our commander in the Far East? Mr. Adams.
General Douglas MacArthur.
General Douglas MacArthur, yes, and putting up a swell fight in the Philippines. Now, how about Russia? Mr. Gunther, do you have your hand up on
that? I think technically Stalin is in supreme charge.
No.
I think not.
I think he named himself commander-in-chief,
of the Far East of the...
Voroshilov, yes.
Voroshilov, Mr. Gunther, does that clear things up now?
I thought you meant supreme commander.
No, I meant just the forces of the Far East. Clementi Voroshilov. Well, that passes us by. Now, how about this one from Rudolph Ailey of Boston, Massachusetts? This is a rather tricky musical question, and it's up Mr. Levant's alley. Now, the studio pianist is going to play, Mr. Levant, some unfamiliar sections of larger works by three great composers. You're asked to play a well-known melody from the larger work that each suggests. In other words, you have to give us a familiar melody in this larger work, and our studio pianist will give you the less well-known part of it. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Let's have the first.
Is that Brahms?
No. Sorry.
Wait a minute. I know that.
All right.
What is it?
That's what he said.
Huh?
You got it now, Mr. Levant?
No. Tell me what it is.
It's from Kindersamen.
By Schumann?
Yeah.
All right. Then I'll do the other one. Then.
All right.
Is that right?
That's right. What is the familiar melody that you're playing?
Pardon?
What is the familiar melody that you're playing?
The way you feel. Tramarai.
Tramarai. Yes, that's right. I'm afraid I handed that to you just a bit, though, Mr.
You didn't hand it to me. I didn't know it.
Suppose I give you about half credit on that. Yeah. You want to try the second one?
I have to. I'm working.
All right. What's that?
That's the Brahms waltz.
All right. What?
The famous A-flat, or known sometimes as the bubble.
Yes, that's the part that we, most of us, are familiar with. What's what number is that in the suite?
Next to the last. 15, I think.
I think it's number four, but...
Oh, no, you're wrong. I know.
Not so sure
it's
about that.
14 or 15, and that's...
You positive of it?
Positive.
Well, at any rate, you've got the right waltz. Oh, boy, wait till I see you after this. It's over, Mr. Levant. And now the third and last. Got that, Mr. Levant?
It's, I think, Gratis et Panassum.
That's good.
Yeah.
And it's from what?
Debussy's Children Corner.
Yes, and now can you give us the part of that that's better known to...
It's all good. I guess the Gollywog, huh?
All right, how about the Gollywog? Love to hear it. Attaboy. Thank you very much, Mr. Levant. That's kind of a tough question. How about this one from George Sloan of Lynn, Massachusetts? Again, get 2 out of 3. It's about islands. In what work of literature do you find each of these islands mentioned prominently? The island of Tahiti. Mentioned where? Mr. Adams.
Any one of Nordoff and Hall's books.
But particularly which one? You're all right, Mr. Adams. What's the one that we know best, Mr. Gunther? Did you...
Well, I was thinking of another book, Somerset Maugham, The Fool and Sixpence.
Yes, that would be very good.
The one of is Pitcairn, which is wrong. Mutiny on the Bounty. Mutiny
on the Bounty. Yes. How does Tahiti come into Mutiny on the Bounty?
It doesn't. It's Pitcairn.
No, I think Pitcairn's also mentioned.
Mutiny on the Bounty.
Several people are put ashore after the mutiny in Tahiti, and then a number of others go ashore at Pitcairn. Both islands come into the...
I think no more gas.
Hall. Beg pardon?
I think no more gas.
Never read it, wouldn't know.
White shadows in the South Sea.
Well, Brian, yes, Tahiti is one of the islands mentioned there. Very good. Now, how about the island of Cyprus comes into what work of literature? The island of Cyprus, Mr. Curran.
Othello, or the War of Venice.
Yes. How many of us remember that the scene of Othello, which all of us are familiar with, is Cyprus, the island of Cyprus? How about Jackson's Island in the Mississippi? Jackson's Island, Mr. Curran.
I believe that a couple of pirates named Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer had a cave
right.
On Jackson's Island.
Exactly, yes. That there is in Tom Sawyer. Well, that gets us by very easily to the next one from Carol F. Higgins of Sharp Park, California. Now, pay attention to this, gentlemen. If a theatrical troupe, including the following people, stopped at the same hotel and put their shoes out at night to be polished, how many shoes would the bootblack have to shine? There's only one possible answer. You understand the problem. Here are the people stopping at the hotel. Next part, ninth act. The Sutherland sisters. Edgar Bergen. And the Foy family. Now, they all stopped at the same hotel and put their shoes out at
the
night.
The Foy family as of today?
No, the Foy today. Family as of yesterday.
Oh.
The Foy family when they were in full force.
I gotta figure that.
Mr. Adams is writing on a black table with black ink.
What was the second one?
Pardon?
What is the second one?
Edgar Bergen.
I have a...
Are you sure you got the answer, Mr. Levant?
No, I'm not sure. I'll be out by 2.
Well, now what? If you are sure you're going to be out by 2...
I'm sure I'll be out by 2. I don't know the Sutherland sisters.
And the other one...
Well, then
don't
tell
me. The Foys?
Yes, well, Sutherland sisters, Edgar Bergen, and the Foy family. Either you know the answer or you don't.
Oh, wait a minute.
If you know the answer...
Can we help one another?
Oh, no.
36 and 14.
No. Say, pardon?
36 and 14.
What is your answer? What's your final answer? How many shoes?
That would be
50,
he would say.
50
shoes?
I'll take 36.
You will?
Yeah, why not?
You're right. 36 is right. Now, I'm much more interested in how Mr. Adams got 50 than I am how you got 36. Mr. Adams, how'd you make 50?
I got 14 from the Sutherland sisters.
14 shoes from the Sutherland sisters, making how many sisters in all?
7 sisters.
Absolutely, that's very good going. 7 Sutherland sisters. Now, how many for Edgar Bergen?
Oh, I got that wrong.
What did you figure?
4.
4 is right, yes. 2 for Charlie McCarthy. I've got with extra tongues in it.
22 and 18.
I beg pardon?
22 and 18.
22 and 18 make how much?
40.
Now, you had 50 before.
Yes, 40 is right.
Boy, you sure are a lightning calculator. the blitz calculator of our time. Now, you had 14 Sutherland sisters, feet, I mean,
yes.
And four.
Four for Bergen.
That's 18. How many for the Foy family?
I had 18.
That's right. Now, 18 and 18 make how much?
36.
Say, that's good going, Adams. Very good. Now, Mr. Levan, how did you get 36?
You want me to be truthful how I got it?
Yeah.
I got 24, and I said to John, how many Sutherland sisters? And he said seven. I got it. And then I figured out from 24,
he figured 24 and 14 were 36.
If I had added correctly with my cheating, I would have been wrong.
You see, dishonesty pays.
Now, I'm it wrong, naturally.
Actually, the correct answer is owed to Mr. Kieran, who told you how many Sutherland sisters.
He didn't know about the Foys.
He didn't know about the Foys. Matter of fact, the only one who knew everything was Mr. Adams, and he just can't add. So I'll have to send $25 to Miss Higgins and a set of the Britannica. And, Mr. Adams, you will get in the morning's mail a third-grade arithmetic in one volume. I think that's all we'll have time for. And now Mr. Cross tells us of a mountain, which in reality is a molehill.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, no doubt you've heard stories about the cost of sponsoring radio programs, of running magazine and newspaper advertisements, and so on. And perhaps you've wondered how much you'd save per pack of cigarettes if there were no such advertising expenditures. Well, this may surprise you, but if Lucky's came straight from the factory to your cigarette counter without a single word or breath of advertising, the price you pay for a package of Lucky's would not be reduced one iota. You see, the total cost of all our advertising is, in reality, such a small fraction of a cent per package that if it were entirely eliminated, the saving per package could not be passed on to you. The makers of Lucky's have always believed that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. The tobacco, not the advertising. And we consistently pay what it costs to get the milder, better-tasting tobacco for Lucky's. For instance, at auctions in Pamplico, South Carolina this season, we paid 28% more than the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture, 34% more at Aberdeen, North Carolina, and so on all over the South. Yes, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Why not make your next package Lucky's and prove to yourself that it's the tobacco that counts?
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out $75 and three sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Gunther, for coming to Lucky Strike's party tonight. Next week, Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran will be with us. And our guests will be, first, Dean Taylor, commentator, composer, and well-known music critic. And second, the distinguished dramatic star, Cornelia Otis Skinner, who is now starring in John Golden's Broadway success, Theater. Remember, for every question that we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. If the question should happen to stump our experts, which happens, you not only get $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Remember to send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, we'll listen to a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, the...